Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, gotta let it go. So
Faster, Fringo!
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate for February 17th, 2026. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on social media at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red boxes to sponsor this podcast and you set up a one-time a recurring donation, no obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank our previous donors. I'm on your hold, your host, actually. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside your other host, Case Low. Case, we got too far into it. I'm not going to do another take of this, bud, but how are you doing this Tuesday?
Oh, Mike Spears, I've been better, but that's okay. I'm happy to be talking to you now. Very happy to be here. Big week in Dragon Gate ahead. Big week on Open the Voice Gate. This is the first of two episodes that are going to hit your feed this week. Thank you for the feedback on last week's episode. Very nice to have that Open the Voice Gate channel buzzing the way that it was. Covered a few different topics in that channel last week. So, you know, as I sit here, I'm always looking for some sort of wrestling to have on in the background, especially as I believe we're still a day away from the NBA season returning post All-Star game. Oh, 2 days away. It's season resumes Thursday with back-to-back Pacers Wizards games, which is deeply unfortunate, but nevertheless, I'm here. I've got a Dragon Gate USA match on in the background, and I'm excited to talk to you about the thing that we always talk about.
Yeah, I'm excited too. Just for a point of comparison, Case, you are watching probably something that I have very fond memories of. I have on right now the Tokyo Pro Wrestling 1996 show that looks like it's taking place in it's at the Olympic Park Gymnasium in Tokyo, where they really just have it facing the entire loading dock the entire time. It's a TWA tag team title tournament that will be main evented and will have several matches of Yuji Anjo that I'm going to try to get through. Okay. So I don't know why I have just such latched on to the 90s dirtbag indies, but I feel like that provides like a certain mindset going into like a week like this, where we have Voice Gate tonight. And then later on in the week, we'll be revisiting those days for the first time in 2026 and talking about the wrestling world in 1995. So I feel like I'm getting myself into that mode with what I'm watching right now. And at the very least, it's a lot of Okamura on these shows. Like, this is what Okamura was up to in the mid-90s. I'm hoping to get to Pro Wrestling Crusaders now.
Well, that sounds awful. I won't be watching any of that. I do love Yuji Anjo. I think historically, I think he's really underrated. I think just not having an extensive period of time, or really any period of time, of one of the two major Japanese promotions in the 90s, or not having a run in Michinoku Pro, which I think probably has the third largest legacy of any of the 90s groups at this point, has been very detrimental to his legacy, because that is a guy who, for those that don't know, I guess the contemporary comp is probably, he was like a shoot style Ozawa, you know, where his work was based in shoot style in the same way that Ozawa is, you know, is at his core a pro wrestling Noah wrestler. But with him, it was all shtick and it was all gimmickry. And I always felt that in the context of shoot style, especially in the matches with Tenryu, that he really shined and brought something different to the table. Whereas maybe I roll my eyes at Ozawa and that it's partially just a contemporary issue of having too many guys like that. Whereas when Anjo did it, it felt like a novelty. But I also, I just find him to be an excellent wrestler, somebody that I placed on Greatest Wrestler Ever in 2016 and somebody that I placed on Greatest Wrestler Ever in 2021.
No, and it's interesting for like how these promotions are. Like also, like Anjo's on the show because this is at a time that the Golden Cups were a thing. So you're also getting Yamamoto and Takayama on this thing. And at least for me, like it's an interesting time frame because this show I'm watching is like 96, I think. 96. Like, so that's after UWFI kind of falling apart and his work that he did in New Japan too. So
yeah,
like
his 96 is his best year, because that he's got a Tenryu match that year, and that is off the top of my head, I believe the last year of the UWFI, and he's definitely. I mean, it's been a decade now since I've gone through that footage specifically, but he was always to me the most entertaining part of that promotion.
Yeah, no. Also on the show, Shocker and Astro Jr. are over.
Yeesh.
Which. Yeah, interesting stuff, but it is something where, like, I think you having the Dragon Gate USA, which show and which match at least you have on at this time?
Well, it's the six-man from the Phoenix WrestleMania, so I guess this would have been mm-hmm. Mercury Rising, so Doi Yoshino Hulk versus Shima Dragon Kid and Gamma, which is only just the YouTube account that I always...
The Mayor of Phoenix.
The Mayor of Phoenix, Gamma. That's right. That's that really made me laugh for some reason. It's sort of the same vein as Sheriff Loki. It always got a good laugh out of me, but I always go to the same YouTube channel to have matches on in the background. While we're recording, and for whatever reason, this jumped out at me as something that I would like to have on in the background right now. And I got to say, I really, really enjoy this era of BB Hulk. So I'm having a very good time watching this.
Yeah, because that's right before the hair match, too. So like you're getting like that last like blast of him before everything would start to change for him after World 2010. And then everything kind of at the when World 1 kind of fall apart. But he's still kind of at, like, in a way, I feel like 2010 Hulk is, outside of 2014, might be one of the more peak years for him in a lot of ways.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's interesting that you have one of the people in this match on your screen, because he's someone we talked about a lot last week. And Shima, we were referring to his what he's doing in his spare time, which we do have a little bit of a follow-up. He's announcing a show that he's going to do for his 30th anniversary and his 29th anniversary in May in Shinjuku Face. So we do have a little bit of follow-up about what was going on with him, and especially that Valentine's Day Eve talk show that he did in I think it was also in Tokyo, but it was about him and he's on the other one, Magnum Tokyo, talking about that there. But off on the heels of kind of like this, like we talk about the Voices of Wrestling Discord and the Open the Voice Gate channel, which is in a lot of ways the best way to keep track of the show is within that channel. We had an interesting discussion kind of pop up coming out of the Shima discussion from one of the Discord users, Pontiff MJ, that case. I think we're just going to, in a lot of ways, I'm handing the ball over for you and letting you lead this from here, but Pontiff brought up, is Shima one of the greatest multi-man wrestlers ever? The number of incredible tags and trios plus matches he's been involved in and has been the shining star of is kind of wild to think about. And Case, this kind of let us kind of go off to the races as we're going to lead off tonight. We'll talk about Uno, Dos, Tres in Kyoto later on in the show, but I hand the ball off to you, buddy, and let's talk about multi-man wrestlers.
Yeah, so I saw this question on the Discord yesterday morning, and it just caught me at a time where I, you know, I had a moment to think about it, and I had a little bit more time in my day yesterday to put into wrestling thoughts than I typically do. And I was very entertained by the question, partially because if you go back to, I believe it was November that we had the discussion on an episode of Those Days about the greatest years in the history of junior heavyweight wrestling. And we were highlighting Sasuke's 1994, and we had a big discussion on that, which if you missed it again, it's on Those Days. I know that that whole segment was clipped out and put on the Voices of Wrestling YouTube channel. That's the type of conversation that at this current point in time in my fandom, I'm very interested in having. I mean, obviously we have the week-to-week Dragon Gate coverage and we have the historical Michinoku Pro stuff, but I'm finding myself really gravitating right now towards just contextualizing history in a way. I find that to be very fun. I've always said, you know, no matter what your opinion on Bill Simmons is, and I Monday, Wednesday, Friday, it's the first thing I put on when I wake up, big fan. But I think that the best thing about Bill Simmons in a very pure and honest way is, especially with the NBA, when something historic happens, he is so good at contextualizing why it matters in the moment, what it means historically, what situations like this have occurred before, and what could happen in the future because of this. And I always think that's when he's doing his best work. And I like taking the show in that direction when I can. So when the question was posed to me of, is Shima one of the greatest multi-man wrestlers ever? I realized that I actually had a lot of thoughts on this. And in particular, four names came to mind immediately. And Shima's one of those names. And four names came to mind so quickly that I then had to really sit and go, okay, I don't want to make this a Mount Rushmore situation. I want to figure out who that fifth person is if I'm going to give you the five best multi-man wrestlers of all time. And so I came up with the criteria of five questions of, were they in a legendary tag team? Were they in legendary trios matches? Not necessarily any sort of legendary trio or faction or unit or stable, but just have they taken part in legendary trios matches? Do they have a unique trait that they bring to multi-man matches? And this is something that should be easily identifiable and easily describable, sure. Almost in the same vein of, like, if you've ever heard Judd Apatow talk about the way that he names movies, you know, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, you know exactly what those movies are just by the title. These wrestlers should have something that is distinct about their performance in multi-man matches that you should be able to label immediately. Question four was, do they have the ability to be the best guy in a match with multiple greats? Because I'm going to give you the list of five names, Mike, and I'm going to tell you right now, they are names that I would consider to be five of the 40 best wrestlers of all time, maybe five of the 50 best, very conservatively. But I think at this point, I would have all of these guys in my top 40, which means that because of the company they keep, they're going to be wrestling some of the other greatest wrestlers in history. So do they have the ability to be the best guy when they're sharing the ring with all-time great wrestlers? And then the final question is, do they wrestle multi-man matches differently than they do singles matches? And that is something that I was outright looking for when thinking about this conversation. I think that's a skill. I think that's why I like the Michinoku Pro Trios matches so much. It's why I like so many of the All Japan 90s Trios matches so much, is because there is a different skill set to wrestling in a six-man tag or an Atomico's match or a 10-man tag than there is in wrestling a singles match. And I would say for most people, they consider Shima to be a better multi-man match wrestler than they do a singles wrestler. I maintain and maintained throughout his entire Observer Hall of Fame candidacy that I think his singles match resume is so incredibly underrated and underappreciated, but I would say that the best work Shima has done in his career has typically been in the multi-man format. So do all of those qualifiers make sense in terms of what I'm looking for here?
Yes, and I think I have a couple people that might not be on your list that I think we should put through the paces through this, the way of like a Gordy list and that kind of thing. Because I think it's a great kind of rubric, just because you can clearly, like, a lot of this is coming from like the idea of Shima as this multi-man wrestler, right? And at his core, and it, like you talk about, like, he has his much maligned, and at this point it's almost become the bit that it's so maligned when it's really not that whatsoever about his singles career here. So yeah, I'm ready to go forward with this. Would you want me to start proposing, guys, or do you want to go through your four guys
first, or take someone
like Shima?
Let me go through my list of five first. And we'll go one at a time here. So let's start with Shima, and we'll go through the rubric. You know, is this a guy who was in legendary tag teams, CK1, Spike Mohicans? And not that I would call them legendary, but I think, as we talked about last week, there is a level of resume with Osaka 06, the Shima and Gamma tag team, where...
Right.
I mean, ultimately, there's a lot of historically revered tag teams that haven't had matches as good as the best Osaka 06 matches. And so I think they are absolutely worthy of being in this list.
Yeah, no, I would also say that when you think about Osaka Zenroku in that kind of way, that you look at the time of the division and the teams that were around and the teams that were kind of around them, and almost all of them in a lot of their ways ended up having some of their better tag matches against that Shima and Gamma team. I think that it gets maligned because of Gamma, but in reality, it's Gamma rising to the occasion and tapping into something of his background, him being an Osaka Pro guy, and it worked very, very well for what it was.
So in terms of legendary trio stuff, Shima, given the companies worked in... Say again?
I was going to say, name the year, name the company.
This is an easier category for him than most, but you have Crazy Max, you have Blood Generation, you have Team Veteran Returns, you have Strong Hearts. Those are just the four that I listed out as the ones that immediately came to mind. I guess, you know, I don't know your answer to this, because I always have a very distinct answer when people ask my favorite era of Shima's career, but I don't know what yours is. If you had to pick a unit and a time frame, do you have one that you always go back to with Shima?
I think it's because he's someone who's had such like a character evolution and like a wrestling evolution as well. Like, it's very hard for me to go like, okay, I think I'm a Crazy Max guy, or no, I think I am really like the Blood Generation through Typhoon Run Shima guy, or times where I'm like, oh no, let's talk about when Shima got to be kind of the god of him that he views himself as. Let's talk about 2010 and 2011. I think that each of those trios, like if you break down like who his real partners were of the time and like what he kind of did in it, you kind of see an evolution of what he was as a trios worker, going from Dandy Fuji and Suo Fuja or Judo Suwa, all the way to like looking at his Blood Warriors work, where he would be doing stuff with Ricochet and add in someone, or he would, whenever they're doing the big highlight stuff, he would be kind of the player coach along with Hulk and Akira, and being like the veteran leader of that kind of thing. Like, he has so many distinct eras of teams, and I think he's such like a singular kind of wrestler that it's hard for me to pick one of the three as my necessarily favorite, because he's kind of a guy for all seasons. It's just what era of him you want to choose.
I've always maintained that I think the two most interesting years of Shima's career are 1998 and 2018, which are, you know, that's the year before Toriumon started, when he's doing work primarily in Michinoku Pro. And then I'm referencing the work that he did immediately leaving Dragon Gate, primarily in Wrestle 1, but also in DDT. I mean, I voted him Flair Thez number one in 2018. I wrote an article at voicesofwrestling.com that year that I believe was titled something along the lines of Conquering the Territories in the Digital Age. And it was talking about how Shima was having, you know, essentially a 1984 type year, but doing it in 2018 and bouncing from promotion to promotion and drawing in promotion, you know, after promotion during that time. And so I find those to be the two most interesting years of his career. But there's nothing wrong with saying 2001 Crazy Max, 2005 Blood Generation. I was struggling to think of the iconic 2011 Blood Warriors trios matches, like specifically trios matches.
They never were trios. Eight Atomicos and higher. But he was the system quarterback for those.
And that's a year where he's with Ricochet for so much of that year. And I find, you know, that tag team to be an iconic one. So very clearly Shima checks those boxes. Do they have a trait unique to them in multi-man matches? Now, for Shima, I have an aura that I'm going to list. For the rest of these guys, it's a very physical in-ring attribute that I attach to them. But for Shima, I have what is just called the look. And we talked about this last week. There is something about the way that he enters the ring that makes him the main character. And that is true when he's 20 years old in Michinoku Pro going against their top stars. That is true in 2001 when Dave Meltzer is talking about him as one of the best wrestlers in the world. That is in 2005. That is very much true when that roster is really churning out well-oiled machines with great units and great concepts and super high-level matches. And that's true all the way throughout his career. There is something about Shima, like Alan in the Discord last night, he referenced the New Hazard versus Typhoon match for May of 2007, which I hadn't watched since probably 2016. A great match. I knew it was a great match, but I had no reason to go back and revisit it until now. And you watch the way that Shima tags in for the first time. And despite it being a great Shingo match and a great BB Hulk match and a great Rio Saito match in particular, Shima gets in the ring and it's just like, oh, this is different. It's the attribute that is always attached to him of, you know, you have some guys that just have this worldly charisma, your Kenta Kobashis, your El Genericos. I've seen it with my own eyes with Bandido. And I think once you watch Bandido in person, you understand him on a different level, where these guys get in the ring and they just feel like stars. And Shima has that unique ability in multi-man matches specifically, where, again, it could be a Crazy Max match in Michinoku Pro. It could be a Blood Generation match. It could be a Strong Hearts match. It doesn't matter what era of his career he's in. He always seems to pull focus in the biggest matches in a way that, you know, if you're working under the nose of Shima, if you're in his company, I can see how that might be a detriment. But as we sit here in 2026, struggling to find proper, for lack of a better term, alpha males in Japanese wrestling, I find the work of Shima to age better than I would have ever expected because he has the ability to have the look. And I will always go back and reference the 2007 Ring of Honor six-man, where you see it in his eyes of like, oh, this is a man possessed who is operating on a different level than everybody else. And oh, by the way, he's sharing the ring with some of the best wrestlers ever in that match.
And I think that the aura doesn't necessarily take away from the match. I mean, just to fire off like a commonly referred to match, March 30th, 2006, the first Dragon Gate Mania six man was a Dragon Kid match, but it was Shima that, like, his star power and the aura and the way that he kind of conducted himself in that was able to be transferable to an audience that most likely with Dragon Kid, other than maybe WCW and then whatever tapes they saw, he was not the name that the crowd was used to. Shima was already doing ROH shots at this time, but he was bringing the whole compliment over, and he was able to lend that aura to the match itself.
In terms of, does he have the ability to be the best guy in the ring with multiple all-time greats? I think that's absolutely true, and I think that is true all the way through 2018. When you're talking about him squaring off with, at the time, a pretty healthy DDT roster, or even the best wrestlers in Wrestle One, he has an ability to pull people up to his level. You know, Jun Tansho being an example. You think about the work that he did with Rio Saito and how, even though Saito on his own at times was a really great wrestler, Shima was always able to pull him up a level that I don't really think anybody else outside of maybe Masaki Mochizuki was able to get out of him. And a lot of that great work comes in those multi-man matches. And then as for, do they wrestle multi-man matches differently than they wrestle singles matches? Absolutely. You know, I think Shima has this really innate ability to heighten things in a way that very few guys have done before. And the interesting thing with him is that he has these three distinct phases where, you know, in 1998, and specifically 98, because it changes once he gets into Toriumon proper, but in 98, he's able to wrestle these multi-man matches as this really antagonistic, rude outsider, this guy who very clearly is different from the fabric in which Michinoku Pro was built on. You know, Shima, by the time that he enters that company, is a complete disruptor to the Michinoku Pro that you and I have been covering on the podcast for the last year. And it's obvious in those matches, that he is taking skills that he learned from working in front of those Arena Nakampone crowds, and he is bringing them into Northeastern Japan. And he's really rude, and he's really antagonistic, and he's very clearly an outsider. And it's just a great thing to see. And as you go along in his career, I mean, if you wanted to tell me that his prime was 2001 to 2011, I certainly wouldn't argue, but let's just use 2001 to 2005 as the example, where now you're talking about this undoubted figurehead of the promotion. He's the most important guy there. He wrestles like he's the most important guy there. You see it when other guys get in the ring with him, that he has the ability, like a Rio Saito, to bring them up to a level that they desperately need to be at if they're going to look credible against Shima. And then he also has that late stage run, starting with the team veteran return stuff, and then moving through 2018 or 2019 with Strong Hearts, where all of a sudden he becomes the wily veteran. And you think about a match like 12-1-16, which, you know, we'll be at the 10-year anniversary of before we know it. That's the Shima, Dragon Kid, Gamma, Masaki Mochizuki, Don Fuji versus the Class of 2016 match with Hyo and Ben and Shun and Yuki Yoshioka and Katsumi Takashima, who has since retired. The best stuff in that match, for as violent as Mochizuki is, for as violent as Don Fuji is, for the novelty of seeing Dragon Kid work a match that style, the best part of that match is when Shima's in the ring with Ben K, because in real time, and now 9.5 years later almost, it still has that, like, oh my God, Ben's going after Shima. Like, let's see how this goes. And that's an emotion that Shima specifically and uniquely is able to pull out of people. So for me, Shima checks all five of those boxes. I think he's very clearly, without going in order, I think one of the best multi-man wrestlers ever.
And really, through his stewardship, I think you could also, as tenuous as an argument can be made, could say, like, the willingness for major American wrestling television to go with Trios and Atomicos and go towards it more in the Luchara style is in direct support of Shima being that kind of figure. Too. Like, I think there's a through line there if you want to make that argument, although it could be a kind of a tenuous one.
Oh, I mean, that was something I leaned on heavily during Hall of Fame season when Shima was still on the ballot, was like, hey, this guy sort of changed the way that wrestling looked, and in a way that I think was far more consequential and legitimately impactful compared to a Jack Evans, Blitzkrieg, Jody Fleisch type wrestler, where it's like, okay, yes, they did change the limits of what you can do physically, and those highlight videos and those early matches in their careers might have been seen by enough eyeballs to inspire people to do things differently. But you know, it goes back to what Gabe said after the Blood Generation Do Fixer six man. He's like, these guys are 5 years ahead of everybody. And that turned out to be largely very accurate. They were almost 10 years ahead of everybody, given, you know, the Shield matches that start in 2013 and beyond from there. That's when you really see that Dragon Gate influence come into play on a large scale North American level.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So Shima, in almost the Shima test, he passed all of it. Who do you have next on your list?
So again, the first four guys I have all came to mind immediately. And I locked in on these four very quickly. And this is in no particular order, but Shima 1 and Kenta Kobashi is the guy that I have at 2. When you talk about the Kobashi tag teams, it's Kobashi and Misawa, it's Kobashi and Akiyama, it's Kobashi and Kikuchi. If somebody wanted to list Kobashi and Johnny Ace as an iconic tag team, I wouldn't fight them. I'm certainly not going to do that. I don't like that stuff as much as other people do. But at the very least, you have three pretty iconic tag teams there. And then you also have, in terms of the trio stuff, you have the big three All Japan Trios matches, 5-26-90, 4-20-91, and 5-22-92. You also get, like, I really have come to enjoy 1999 All Japan once Baba has passed, and it's very clearly Misawa's company, but Misawa, out of respect to Baba and to the TV contract, is still in All Japan pre-Exodus, where, like, All Japan gets really, really weird in 99. And, like, there's a great, this one's from 98, actually, but it's Kobashi and Johnny Ace and Hiroshi Hase against Gary Albright, Yoshiro Takayama, and Kakahara from July of 98. Like, Kobashi's awesome in that match. He's great in all of those early 2000s burning six-man tags. I rewatched a match yesterday. It was Kobashi, Kenta, and I gotta look it up now because I'm blanking on their partner, and I want to make sure that I get this right because I want people to watch this match. But this really ties into just the greatness of Kobashi in these trios matches. So it was a busy day on YouTube yesterday. Really got to scroll on this one. It was Kobashi, Kenta, and Tomon Honda against Yoshihiro Takayama, Takashi Sugiura, and Daisuke Ikeda. This is from May 9th, 2003 in Korakuen Hall. And this starts to illuminate the thing with Kobashi is that if Shima has the look, Kobashi has two different things depending on the era of his career that he can lean on. In the 90s, and if you're somebody that's largely unfamiliar with 90s Kenta Kobashi, but knows, you know, his Pro Wrestling Noah version, this might be surprising to you. But in the 90s, it's the wounded dog selling from Kobashi. It's his leg is in so much pain that he might die in the middle
of the
ring.
One of the best baby faces in peril in wrestling history is 1990s Kobashi. Yeah.
And it's detached from the work that he does in those singles matches. It looks a little bit different. I think he was very good at incorporating the idea of teamwork into those matches. So Orange Tights Kobashi, it's all about the selling and how much pain he can take, sacrificing himself for the betterment of the team, sacrificing himself to reach, you know, the tournament finals, the tag belts, whatever it may be. In the 2000s, and it's very apparent if you go and watch Kobashi and Honda and Kenta versus Takayama, Sugiura, and Ikeda, it is the, oh shit, we upset dad hot tag that he has. And the fascinating thing with that match in particular is, okay, it's one thing if Kobashi tags in and he's got Ikeda or especially that era of junior heavyweight Sugiura in the ring where it's like, oh, okay, they're about to die. Like, you know, Korakuen would get injured no matter what. But when Kobashi makes his hot tag in that match, he's in the ring with Takayama. And even then, he goes straight into the corner and lights him up with chops. And that is just a reoccurring bit throughout all of those burning tags in the early 2000s is it's the, you know, business just picked up to steal the JR line. Like the Kobashi hot tag is a very specific thing that would often imply immediate violence and immediate pain onto his opponents. And it's not just the punching down, you know, let me look for the junior heavyweight in the match and beat the crap out of them. It was great when he would have a tag with Misawa on the opposite end or Akiyama on the opposite end or Takayama on the opposite end. And he was still able to go right at them and have the same level of fear and connect with the audience in that way as it would him beating up somebody half of his size.
Yeah, and I think that in a lot of ways, like the angry dad thing is built up off of the Orange Tights kind of Kobashi mythos in a lot of ways that like he was after the way that he was treated as a young boy and essentially like in the Super Generation Army, like where he was kind of there coming out of the tag team with Misawa and with that, like it's in a lot of ways that wounded dog has become old and grizzled, and if you attack his pack, he's going to destroy you. And it's a completely kind of different style of energy of hot tag that I feel like that there were people who kind of had like a uh-oh, dad's angry kind of style of hot tag well before him, but in a lot of ways his style of hot tag kind of I identify it with him in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he was always the best at it. You know, Kawada had a certain look in his eyes that he was able to get over. Taue, I mean, at his very best, you would sometimes see that. I am personally at a level right now where I am just so cold on Misawa's work that it's really hard for me to evaluate him in this sort of context. But, you know, Misawa at times, especially, I think during that prime run was able to accomplish that. But I think Kobashi had the greatest grumpy hot tag that there ever was. You know, was he able to be one of the best wrestlers or be the best wrestler in a match with all-time greats? I think Kenta Kobashi is the greatest wrestler of all time. So yes, he was able to accomplish that. I mean, I think a lot of those great 90s All Japan tags, I go back to Kobashi's work and focus on that more than Kawada, more than Taue, more than Misawa, more than Akiyama as we get later into the 90s, more than Hansen in the early part of the 90s. Like, I think a lot of the time in some of the greatest matches ever, Kobashi is the best guy in those matches. And I think that's an interesting part when you talk about, you know, does he approach multi-man matches differently? You know, Kobashi in those matches is oftentimes not the sole focus. But I think Kobashi, especially in that environment, was able to demonstrate the idea of suffering, both in terms of himself suffering and also causing his opponents to suffer. I just think he was able to get that across in a way that was so efficient and so unique to the setting. You know, when I think about 90s Kobashi, I mean, there's a string of matches in 98 where he has the five-star match with Kawada in June, which I think is the single most underrated match of the 90s. And then he's got the five-star match with Akiyama a month later. The early 90s, he's got the great Hansen matches. He's got a great jumbo singles match in 1991. You know, as you get later on in that decade, there's a few great Misawa singles matches. But when I think about Kobashi in the 90s, I think about him as a tag wrestler. I think about him as a six-man tag wrestler, really churning along some of the greatest six-man tags that we've ever seen. And for whatever reason, a lot of the Noah multi-man matches during the era in which Kobashi was most active in that promotion, they're great. They don't have any legacy whatsoever. Nobody's talking about early 2000s Noah six-man tags, but they're great. And the matches that Kobashi's in, they're great because Kobashi's in them.
Yeah, no, Kobashi was not a name that I was going to throw in for this, but I totally see your argument here, and I fully agree. Yeah, no. Go ahead.
Third guy on the list was Junichiro Tenryu. Again, we're talking about some of the greatest wrestlers of all time. In terms of tag teams, Jumbo and Tenryu, Tenryu and Hansen, Tenryu and Kawada. I think that Tenryu and Kawada tag team is really, really underrated, and I really like what they did in 88 and 89. I think that Tenryu Hansen tag team is really, really underrated, especially with what they did in 88. In terms of the multi-man matches, the six-man tags and beyond, you've got the WAR New Japan feud in 92 and 93, which might be my favorite work that Tenryu ever did. That is a really hard thought that I've never really sat down and thought like, hey, what's the best thing that Tenryu was ever a part of? But it might be that feud. And then you also have less six-man tags in 80s All Japan. You know, that was something that we saw really come into focus in the 90s after Tenryu had left. But I always go back to, there's a six-man tag from March 8th of 1989, and it's Tenryu and the Road Warriors against Jumbo, Yoshiaki Yatsu, and Shunji Takano. And I don't know if there's ever been a match that has the atmosphere that this match has. It is like getting beamed onto another planet when you sit down and you watch this match and you see the charisma of Tenryu and the charisma of Jumbo in this era and the charisma of the Road Warriors and just the way that the crowd is feeding off of every single movement that everybody makes. And so, yeah, Tenryu, I think, despite not really ever having a legendary trios team, I think was a part of a number of legendary trios and multi-man matches.
Yeah, and I think with Tenryu, like, you get to see, at least in the later parts, like, getting into the 90s and getting, like, Takano as, like, a figure and the and just, like, his mindset and what all came in with SWS into WAR and how that became such a vein for international talent to also get into Japan at a time that I think that there's a lot of stuff in war and SWS that very clearly died the death that it felt like it should die. And a lot of the theories that we actually talked about on those days behind SWS and like this vein of promotion that was just destined to fail as it was. But just I feel like with him, he has like a lot of his WAR stuff wasn't necessarily with the internationals, but I think that like just like that kind of figure is so interesting as it relates to a multi-man wrestler, and especially in the path that kind of wove in and out of the traditional powers in that time period.
It's funny that I didn't mention anything WAR specific. I mean, obviously there's the New Japan feud, but I lean on especially the matches that took place in New Japan during that time period, because I was thinking last night about just WAR as a promotion, and it's a promotion that I somehow feel like historically I have a very strong awareness of.
Mm-hmm.
I I know the matches that matter. I know why the promotion mattered. And yet at the same time, I also feel like I have no grasp on that promotion whatsoever. Does that make sense?
It was a lot of things. Oh, no, I think that's a very valid concern about Russell and Romance case. A lot of stuff was happening at the same time in those promotions because, like, I think it was like a couple of weeks ago, I was watching the second anniversary show. It was the one that had the Ultimo and Sasuke match on that show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was part of it was because I was in the mood just because I got myself in a wiki hole that I wanted to watch Buko Dojo stuff, essentially. So I was like really geared in because it was the 6-man tournament. And it was just like, okay, the way that they would just like, this is our anniversary. We're running Ryo Goku for this. And we're bringing in John Tenta, but we're going to like try to be very careful about John Tenta being around Katao about this. And actually at this time, this might have been before the actual like explosion between those two, but like just a lot of things were happening and a lot of people going in and out. You had a team, what do they call Fuyuki with Jado and Gato at that time? I think it was Fuyuki Army.
Yeah, sure.
That sounds right. It was just a lot of stuff happening. And then bringing in Sasuke and bringing in Jinsei Senzaki. Like, I don't know that Tenryu's, like, that him being a booker was ever really a great idea when he was in charge of his own promotion. It just seemed like that there was a lot of cooks going on. And I think, like, also for me, the fact that, like, I grew up around, like, the Mick Foley and Chris Jericho autobiographies, mm-hmm. and especially like when those were released, I was like a preteen and teenager and I devoured them, and I would have like a memory of like these like 90s Japanese indies like talked about from like Jericho and Foley. I know didn't work WAR, but like still was like of that time period that always kind of colored it in a mythological kind of sense. And then as I watch more and more of WAR, the more I'm going like, no, this is a problem with a lot of, this is a promotion with a lot of issues, and no wonder it flamed out the way it did and what it came out of. Like, it was a hot mess its entire time.
Yeah, I mean, we're fully committed to those days, and we're going to start churning out more of these episodes here, but that is a promotion that I would like to at some point sit down and try to watch in some sort of order that would make sense. But I can't point to any specific WAR 6-man tag that Tenryu was in that didn't involve the New Japan guys, but nevertheless, bunch of great 6-man tags. For Tenryu, the easily identifiable trait for him, and I wrote about this in my January Dragon Gate Korkin review, oddly enough, was the art of standing on the apron. Tenryu was able to do so much when he wasn't in the ring. I think about his run in Noah, especially in the 2000s, and the first thing that comes to mind is him launching water bottles at people and just how effective he was at not being in the match, but still being involved. And I think that's a skill that unfortunately is being lost in Japan. It's a skill that has never really made its way to America in a way that
I find. The only person who does it enough is Don Fuji, the person that more people should pattern their wrestling off of.
And Fuji patterned his wrestling off of Tenryu. So it's the vicious cycle that never evolved.
I mean, Tenryu was responsible for him putting food on the table for a couple of years before Toriyama. Like, he's showing the proper respect that it deserves.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of being the best guy in a match with all-time greats, I mean, look, I think Tenryu is the best guy in a lot of those 80s All-Japan tags. He is the guy that forces Jumbo Tsuruta to adapt once Choshu and Yatsu come in. And I've talked about this before, but one of my favorite eras in all of wrestling history is that 86 to 88 All-Japan period where Choshu and Yatsu come in 85, and it's strange. Like, that is not an awesome in-ring year for the promotion with the footage that we have, but by January of 86, we have the first all-time great Choshu and Yatsu versus Jumbo and Tenryu match, and that January one specifically is sort of the textbook example of, hey, here's why Riki Choshu is also an all-time great. But after that, it's a lot of great Tenryu stuff. And as that promotion evolves into the late 80s and you get that Tenryu and Hansen tag team and you get that Tenryu and Kawada tag team, it's just remarkable that this guy is churning out the level of classics that he was churning out. Have you seen the Tenryu and Hansen versus Giant Baba and Rusher Kimura match from, I think, late 89?
89. Yeah, no, wasn't that like the one where it was like the first time Baba took a fall in like a decade or something?
Probably.
Or at least to a native wrestler.
Because they jump Baba at the start of that match. And look, there's...
Right, yeah.
And I've
seen this one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm going to sound like an asshole here, and I'm not going to try to. There's a contingent of people that will be like, oh, that's the best match of 80s All Japan. No, it's not. It's the same thing as like, oh, you know, Tower's actually the best of the four pillars. Like, no, he's not. And Tower's an all-time great, but no, he's not. And this is a really, really great match, but it's not the best of the 80s All Japan. But if you've never seen that match, it is so simple. And Baba and Tenryu and Hansen are all so fucking great in that match at playing their roles to the best of their ability. And so it just in terms of a tag match, I want to be sure to mention that one. Tenryu, in terms of does he work multi-man matches differently than does he work singles matches, I think he probably has the least difference in the way that he works these two styles of matches. But I often found, especially in the 80s, that Tenryu was a better multi-man wrestler than he was a singles wrestler. As you get into the 90s and as you get into the really simplified version of his offense in the 2000s, sometimes that would play better in singles matches. But I've always found a lot of the best Tenryu stuff to be in multi-man environments.
Yeah, and I think also some of that is like the amount of like tag runs he really had in All Japan leading into like that let him kind of in a lot of ways he put in the work. So when you had SWS and WAR, then he goes and bounces around in the 2000s. He has that like cachet that lets him do that, I feel like. And I think also like considering the fact that Tenryu like debuted in 76, he was doing this at essentially in his 40s and his 50s at that time period. It is also, I think, something like where you could say like it's him like having like that kind of outsized presence on the apron in the tag scenarios allows him in a lot of ways to like be able to impact the match without physically getting involved as much too. I mean, I think there's a level of respect of knowing your audience. I mean, we talked about Shima having like that kind of aura, that aura can work in that in different ways. And Tenryu used the aura to be the best person going for a hot tab outside of Gibson, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So hopefully people are finding this interesting. My fourth on the list, and we can, I'll try to speed this up just a little bit, just in case people are not into this, but El Hijo del Santo. I was kicking around a few luchadors. I seriously considered Místico for this list because I think as
Místico was one of my names I was going to throw in here.
Okay, because you know, yeah. I went through a lot of his 2004, 2005, 2006 stuff about a year or two ago now, and really, really enjoyed that work. And I think Sky Team has hit the same point that Z-Bratz hit towards the end of their run, where they had such an insanely high floor. You know, there was just a certain formula where for what I value out of wrestling, it's like, oh man, the worst version of this is like 3¾ stars and I leave with a smile on my face. And so he was somebody that I considered, but I went with Santo here. In terms of the legendary tag teams, you have the Eddie tag team, you have the Negro Casas tag team, and you also have, I think it was only like 3 or 4 matches, but the tag team with Místico in 2004, I love the footage we have of that, and I think they're such a fun team, and I wish Santo's
The Grand
ego,
Alternativa.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I wish Santo's ego would have let that team play out a little bit more, because I found their dynamic with the old and young there to be really, really interesting. And then in terms of the trio stuff, you've got the work that he did in Universal. You've got him being the best all-out wrestler in AAA from 1993 to 1995. You have the Negro Casas feud of the late 90s in CMLL. And then again, you have that last run that he had in CMLL in 2002, 2003, 2004. And then I guess a little bit in 2005 where he's physically limited at that point, but he's so smart and he's such a great worker that even at that point, being limited offensively, he was able to maximize every single thing that he was able to do. It's sort of funny, like watching Ultimo now, because Ultimo can't really do anything, but there's still a part of him where he's able to milk the most out of nothing. And that is very clearly something that got taught to Santo and Ultimo and that era of Luchador along the way, because Santo, 2004 Santo, is able to move around much better than 2026 Ultimo is, but you still see that same thing where it's like, God, they're getting a reaction for every footstep they take. Like, they are just able to pull something out of this crowd that I think is a lost art. I don't think it's a skill. I think it's an art, and I think it's been lost along the way, and that era of Luchador seems to have it.
Yeah, talking about milking in Ultimo, that there's definitely a thing in the Kyoto show where he still has the ability to milk the Mexican stretch with Kazuma Kimura at the very least.
In terms of, was he the best worker in a match with all time greats? I mean, look, I going through that 1993 AAA footage, there was a noticeable difference when Santo was involved in a multi-man match, and even with all the Blue Panther stuff and the La Parca stuff that I really liked that year and the stuff that Eddie's involved with, it's just when Santo's in one of those scenarios, it is noticeable just how great he is. Does he approach singles matches differently than he does multi-man matches? I'm not the biggest authority on this, but I will lean heavily on the 90s AAA footage that I've seen of Santo, where, you know, his big singles matches are worked in this old school type of environment where it's really mat based. You know, he has, I think, 5 televised singles matches with heavy metal in 1993, and they're not spotty. You know, it's not the most exciting thing you've ever seen, but it's efficient, and I like watching him work on the mat. But when you watch him in trios matches, that's when you get to see that raw athleticism. That's when you really get to see that crowd connection. And I think I skipped over it, but the identifiable trait that Santo has is he has the best hot tag ever. There's nothing quite like seeing him do that flipping senton onto somebody in the middle of the ring and then seeing Santo roll to his feet and hit the tope suicida next to the ring post, you know, the corner of the ring, the way that he does that. There's just nothing like that in the history of wrestling. And I think that as time goes on and I watch more and more of him and I just watch more and more wrestling, I think at his peak, I think Santo probably has the best hot tag ever.
And I think part of it, like when you think about like how his role was for like those, the start in the first few years of AAA and like that kind of figure, like it makes sense that with television and especially with the way that they're trying to like build up and the kind of ego that he is, that that his singles matches are worked so distinctly different. You know, I mean, he is still that star of that era, and he's able to kind of, especially like at that point of the nascent days of promotions, push around Pena enough to do the matches he kind of wants to do in that style too. So I feel like almost a hidden six question is, how much of this does this wrestler have of an ego, and how much of it do they believe in their abilities and using that to kind of dictate their presence in a lot of ways? Because I feel like that outside of Kobashi, there is a huge a through line of ego, I think we could say, about most of these candidates.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I guess I'd be curious to know if you think that applies to the fifth wrestler that I have on this list. And again, I kicked around a lot of names. I put a lot of different names through this test. I looked at Hamada and I was like, well, you know, he doesn't really have a legendary tag team, and he wasn't in a legendary trio, and it's okay, it's not Hamada. And I was like, Mochizuki maybe, but I felt like there was somebody outside of Dragon Gate that I was trying to get to. And I started looking at the United States quite a bit, and I was trying to figure out sort of from the Shield to now, like, okay, who's the person that benefited most from this style? Just qualifying the Young Bucks, because the Bucks would be the answer. And there are times where, honest to God, I watch Nick Jackson wrestle. And there are times where I watch Nick Jackson wrestle, and I wonder if he's the single greatest wrestler ever. Like, it's a thought that has crossed my mind more than once recently, where I wonder if, because they're a tag team, that the Bucks are just being slighted. And I think they're the greatest tag team ever, and I still wonder if they're being slighted in this historic way, and that Nick Jackson specifically, it's like, ah, man. So if the Bucks counted, the Bucks would be the answer. But who did the Bucks wrestle a lot of trios matches with over the last decade? And this plays into, I talked about the overconsumption era that we live in and just the mass amount of content, and how as time goes on, it's going to be really, really hard to analyze some of these legacies properly. Because, you know, by the time that you and I started following Japanese wrestling, Kobashi's career was already canonized, and Tenryu's career was already canonized, and Santo was on the downslope of his career. And, you know, Shima, you know, you and I both know because we're fanatical about him, but I feel like it's like, okay, well, let me think about the last 10 years and, you know, almost the last 15 now, and who has benefited from this embrace to some degree. I still think America largely does trios wrestling incorrectly, but who has benefited from embracing trios wrestling in a North American way? And I think the answer for who the fifth guy in the five greatest multi-man wrestler ever conversation is Kenny Omega. And Omega has the Golden Lovers tag team, and he has the Hangman Page tag team. When you talk about the trio stuff, you've got, if you go to Cage Match and just filter in through the match guide, just Omega match guide tag teams and trios matches, I mean, there's almost 100 matches of him and the Bucks as a trio that are at like 7.0 and above. It's astronomical how many great trios matches these guys have been in. It's one of the things I always say where, you know, visually we're processing the world in a different way now. And so if Omega and the Bucks have the resume of trios matches that they have in starting in 1995 instead of 2015, then all of a sudden those matches are listed out on the Ditch website, and you get to see a mega list on a forum, and you get the comp DVD that's the two discs of all of their great trios matches, and suddenly it just becomes ingrained in your DNA that, hey, Kenny Omega has been in like 100 legitimately great six-man tag team matches in the last decade. But because we're not doing that, and because at best a lot of the cataloging you're getting now is either Cage Match, which we're not inputting, or your own personal spreadsheet, which is just sort of a filled out as you go thing, it gets lost in the mix, you know, the anarchy in the arenas matches and all of the great stuff with the Death Riders. And then there's the Bucks and Omega against Death Triangle, best of seven series that I was such a huge fan of. And then there's stuff like, I thought there were way more men of low moral fiber tag matches than there were.
That's what I was about to bring up. Like, think about his stuff that he even did as like side quest stuff of Chuck Taylor.
But there's only like five Omega Taylor tag matches, which I was stunned by. I thought they had
and
like 15.
Isn't like one of them like a DDT4?
That's most of where they cheated, right, the DDT4. Yeah. That's where most of those matches came from. But they do have the Omega, Chuck Taylor, Zack Sabre Jr. versus Young Bucks, Adam Cole trios match from Bola 2014. So if you want to collectively put the Omega, Chuck Taylor tag teams and that trios match together, it's like, all right, now you've got a little bit of a resume there. In terms of what Omega does better than anybody else, I think the way that finishing stretches in matches, and especially epic matches, have been put together has largely changed over the last 10 years, largely changed especially over the last 15 or 20 years. I, for as much as I enjoy modern wrestling, would certainly listen to an argument that maybe the way we're putting together finishing stretches is actually bad for wrestling, and certain wrestlers are very bad at doing it. But I think in singles matches, Omega is one of the best to ever do it. And I think in trios matches, I think Omega, his skill is the finishing stretch. I think this guy has put together some of the most iconic finishing stretches in the history of pro wrestling in these tags and multi-man matches.
Yeah, and I think especially when you like look at just the Bucks run, and like when you're thinking about like a non-standard trio, it is definitely the one that I think that within the next, really, right now, we should be like reassessing it as probably like one of the best like trios of this generation. And where does it stack up against like your Missionarios, Del Muerte, Brazos, and people like that? In a lot of ways, like just because like they have that level of a resume at this point that you can compare it in a way, like not explicitly one-to-one, just because of like, especially for those two trios, how they kind of revolutionized it within Mexico and kind of created the match as we know it now. But if we're like looking at like that kind of style of trio and really like what is like the best example of it within the last 15 years, that's kind of the one that the more you think about and wrap your head around it, it's like, okay, that's the kind of the one of the trios that you would want to put up against those like historical great ones.
So That's a really interesting point. So is the evolution of the six-man tag essentially whatever was happening in Universal Mexico that we largely don't have footage of, that we get glimpses of in Hamada's Universal, that becomes the Michinoku Pro tag, which becomes the Toriumon tag and the Dragon Gate tag, which is slightly different. Is the evolution of that the Bucks Omega six-man style?
I kind of feel like it is. I could hear arguments. I mean, like, the one of the names that I was going to put forth in this that I feel like, interestingly enough, like, he checks some of the boxes, but I think the larger question is about, like, him and how he wrestles now would be, like, a Claudio Castagnoli, you know, because of, like, how he was, like, you have the tag teams like Chris Hero for that. You have the fact that he, especially when you look at, like, with the skills that he developed in Chikara, put onto an international stage, one of, like, considered one of the best catchers and basers for younger or smaller wrestlers in the world. And that's kind of been his role, including, like, his run around the ring hot tag as kind of, like, a secondary aspect of it. But you don't have, like, that, that like, definite, like, Claudio trio, though. I guess, like, you wouldn't say the BDK trio with Ares and Tursus, I think was that guy.
Yeah, I'm sure some people might, but I don't know that era of Claudio's career enough to say one way or another.
I do, and I'm hesitant to say that.
Yeah, and there's not enough Claudio Danielson Quackenbush matches. Which is something
because Danielson never really was around Chikara until Chikara was able to pay for him.
Yeah,
to be honest.
Yeah.
and then he was only there for the shows that would sell thousands of DVDs.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how that works. So it's funny you mentioned Claudio because I thought about Mox, but Mox
doesn't get the Shield stuff, and yeah,
you have the Death Rider stuff, but Mox doesn't really have a tag team. I mean, with all due respect, not really going to count the Switchblade Conspiracy in this conversation. That feels like a look. If Rob Naylor wants to do a podcast on it, that's fine. I'll hop on the pod. But
we can talk about some pro wrestling Ohio if he really wants to.
I mean, unfortunately, I saw a clip of 2012 Sammy Callahan a few days ago, and I was like, God damn, did I enjoy that era of his career. So, like, I get it, but we're doing something higher than Switchblade Conspiracy here. So Mox doesn't really have the tag team element of it, which I think is really interesting. And Claudio has the Kings of Wrestling stuff, but doesn't really he was never really in those Shield matches. So he's as odd as this.
He was a part of traffic in the Shields matches. Like the most, and when you like look at those Shield matches, you have someone who I think that would have been another candidate in Bryan Danielson, who I feel like was the real ring general getting those matches across the finish line.
Yeah, Danielson was the one that I was really trying to make work, and I just couldn't justify it in this conversation. But he's.
Because, like, what would it be, like, his real tag team that you would consider for it? Like, you couldn't consider, like, his New Japan tag team.
What's the best Danielson tag team? Well, the best Danielson tag team is him and Austin Aries in 2008 Ring of Honor.
Okay, that's fair.
That stuff is so underrated. Like, there's a Danielson-Aries versus Motor City Machine Guns match that if it happened now, people would vote it fucking match of the year. It's unbelievable how good it is.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, I appreciate you making the point about Young Bucks, like you can't use like an established tag team here because like the answer could have been like, think about Alex Shelley here. But I think of him now like really like in 2026 eyes as a tag team wrestler, not as someone as with like the significant amount of the singles work that you could differentiate him away from.
Yeah. Aries and Danielson. God, they are such a good team. Aries, it makes me sick that Aries is as underrated as he is. So it's a very short run. They wrestle Jigsaw and Ruckus on one show. They wrestle Go Shuizaki and Nigel McGuinness on another show, which I just watched that. It was very good. And
yeah,
then
I remember that one rocking.
There's this great, oh God, this match is so, I got to go rewatch this. I got to see if it's on YouTube. It's Respect Is Earned 2. Jimmy Jacobs and Tyler Black defending the Ring of Honor world titles against Aries and Danielson. And so this is right in the throes of the big Jacobs Aries feud in Ring of Honor. And there's also a lot of Danielson and Black going on at the time. And that match is so good. And it's, you know, I mean, Age of the Fall, they hold their own there, but that it's a masterclass in Danielson and Aries. And then there's the from Virginia, Ring of Honor Fueling the Fire 2008, Aries and Danielson versus the Motor City Machine Guns. And that match is just incredible. Top three on this show. I certainly have never seen this show in full. I've only seen that match because the top three, Brent Albright versus Chris Hero, Ring of Honor World title match, Nigel McGuinness versus Ruckus, and Ring of Honor World Tag Team title match, Jimmy Jacobs and Tyler Black versus Goshi Ozaki and Naomichi Marufuji. And I don't even know if I've seen that tag title match before.
I remember that Ruckus World title challenge because Ruckus won the Honor Rumble, and that was like the one time that they ran a battle royal.
So
that show didn't ring a bell until you mentioned that ROH title match.
To put a bow on the Omega thing, I think the thing that he's really good at in terms of differentiating singles matches from multi-man matches is I do think Omega gets the idea of teamwork or playing in a team. I think he gets that idea across really well in his matches. There is, in the Ibushi stuff and in the Hangman stuff and with the Buck stuff, he's very good at demonstrating that he has an emotional connection to his partner, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think Kenny's like touch of melodrama has in a lot of ways that there are certain parts that I think that people have gone off to the races with, but I think when you look at it as like a pure in-ring kind of thing, like it adds so much to a lot of his work with Golden Lovers and like that connection and the Cowboy Bebop tag team was like one of there's a part of me that wonders like seeing Adam Page being in this kind of position where like, man, that where he is now versus where he was on July 13th of last year feels like, oof, what did he do specifically to do this? And there's a part of me that goes like, I know we're doing Kenny towards the title, but Kenny's like making that run here, but I kind of want to see that tag team back together because they really had something special in that run.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that goes to just the way that America treats tag teams and somehow, some way, the Gato Book New Japan has been the company to embrace tag teams in a way that I never really thought I would see. But yeah, I'm with you. I think Hangman and Kenny have another run in them. So my top five, in no particular order, in terms of the best multi-man wrestlers ever, Shima, Kenta Kobashi, Junichiro Tenryu, El Hijo del Santo, and Kenny Omega. And again, you're talking about five of the 40 greatest wrestlers ever. Santo would be the one that I would have in that 40 to 50 range. But I think at this point, I have Santo in the 30 to 40 range. It's just a matter of where I want to place him. So you're talking about five all-time greats, and that's what I landed on. I would be curious if there are any names that I did not mention that you want to throw out just real quick as names that came to mind when you were posed with the question.
Well, I brought up Claudio. I do think that Claudio, if we're looking at for like wrestlers in his position and really kind of when you look at these kinds of matches, and he's been someone that, I mean, you're really talking about someone who's been capable of doing these kind of matches for 20 years now, that like his role as the big guy essentially, and just like uniquely like working with flyers like Ricochet early into his career, and how he's basically been able to have like those kinds of presence. And when you like look at like other guys who kind of get put into a similar position, at least as when we talk about Dragon Gate, you can look towards like a Luis Monte, and I think that there's a lot of how that kind of tall wrestler works in multi-man matches, at least in the modern era, that can be linked back to Claudio. Because when you think about it, he's someone who's essentially had this kind of role off and on for 20 years. He wrestles completely different in tag matches than he wrestles as a singles. And I think it outside of just like his basing and catching, I know how you feel about the Hijo del Santo hot tag. When Claudio does the carnage around the ring hot tag and starts doing uppercuts and just goes around and destroys everyone for like a lap around the ring. That's one of the reasons why we watch pro wrestling and stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So Claudio is like the I guess you would say more North American wrestling name I would put there with this. I appreciate not just filling up the list with Dragon System people when it's very easy to do so in a lot of ways. But
yeah, no, I mean, I think 80s All Japan is some of the best tag team wrestling ever. Mm-hmm. I think 90s All Japan has the benefit of being some of the best tag team wrestling ever. And it has some of the, I mean, 420-91 is maybe the best trios match ever. And I think the 1992 version of that match is not far off. I mean, I think you have to, if you're going to have this conversation, you have to look past high spot Lucha Wrestling trios matches and also mention the heavyweights of the 80s and 90s.
And I think when you like consider like that, there are people that I like certain aspects of them as a multi-man wrestler that like necessarily does not lend itself to a list like this. Like, I think for like the kind of six-man tags that they were doing in the 80s, the way that I don't think the Von Erichs were necessarily like the in-ring workers that kind of really were the ones that like pushed it. But I think like a certain level of direction should be looked at Terry Gordy when you think about him working in that style and then moving on to like the Murder Violence Connection and all of his work in Japan. He is a figure that I think that if we're trying not to look at this just in a Lucha Wrest lens, like he is someone that I think he is one of like when you start looking at it, one of the best like multi-man workers of all time. If you think about it with this, I don't know how he really applies to this rubric though.
Yeah. Gordy's work in America is a pretty big blind spot for me, but that's an intro. I mean, that's not somebody that I had thought of. So that's a very interesting shout.
Because like you also think about like the stuff he would do in Mid-South leading up and in and around it. And of course you have the Freebirds versus Von Erich feud and all of that. And that's not necessarily the looking for a work rate kind of feud. But if you want to look at like at one of those kind of crucial moments in a promotion's history, you have him then there and then you pull him into Japan and his work there. I mean, at least up until his health issues really got bad in the 90s, like you're talking about essentially like a 10-year stretch of a guy who I think that you look at his work that he deserves a level of conversation there.
I'd be curious to know, obviously, if people enjoyed that, because I really like doing stuff like that. I'd like to do more stuff like that on the show, but if people don't like it, then we won't do it. But specifically, who are the North American, or I guess US and Canada names, who are the names that come to mind there? Because that's what I really struggle with, and I landed on Omega. Again, I really kicked around Mox, but I don't think Mox has a tag team, and so if we're ranking
the
very
best
ever,
Danielson,
yeah,
really, because like I feel like Danielson is such a smart worker that like when you're talking about like top 10 wrestlers of all time, he's one of the top 10 wrestlers of all time in my opinion, and the way that he has been able to really like work across just different eras and different styles of the match. And I mean, I don't think, at least from my personal taste, WWE has done anything as good as that Shield run and since then.
Oh,
and
God,
I think,
no. Oh,
and
I
think
mean,
that he
yeah.
is responsible to be the foil and like the right person in that kind of situation for that kind of match. I guess like the one aspect about this that maybe that if we want to call this like an end of part one and then we can see people's response and we can come back to this is when we're thinking about multi-man stuff, I'm wondering how much should we consider not just the idea of just tags, trios, atomicos, what have you, but how much are we also considering like three-way dances necessarily? Like the idea, not even like three-way dances, but like three-way tags and such like that aspect of multi-man working.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because my instinct is that just feels very Dragon Gate specific, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but yeah.
I mean, you look at how just on AEW TV, there was a three-way tag match last week. You know, like it's not, it's something that maybe because we often look things in the dragon system lens, we think about like three way, four way. I mean, we're going to talk about a three way six man coming up this weekend. But I think that that when you like extend it, like just past like the idea of that, like, and even in a level of consideration, like thinking about like three way dance matches, like starting like with ECW in 95, like, are we at a point where there's enough of a differentiation between like these kinds of matches that this can be a variable to be worth considering? Or is this something that it's its own distinct different thing? Or as you were saying, it's too lucha-esque coded to really pertain it as a possible variable in this discussion.
And I guess to put a bow on this discussion again, I really try to look at this not as, hey, who's been involved in the most great matches? I think that's, I think all of these guys align with that theory as well. You know, these guys have, you know, just gobs and gobs of great multi-man matches, but it's specifically the skills in which they're using in those matches that I find to be the most interesting thing. And so, you know, again, we're dealing with some of the greatest wrestlers ever. You know, Kobashi and Tenryu are in my top five. Shima in my top 25, Omega in my top 30, Santo in my top 40. So you're going to get lengthy list of like, hey, a 4-star match, 4.5-star match, whatever it may be. But I think it's a more nuanced discussion than just counting the star ratings and looking at who has the most. I think that's why, say, Shima's on this list and Mochizuki isn't, just to clarify that there.
Yeah, no, that's entirely fair. Moving on and looking back towards Dragon Gate, we are just...
Let's talk about this ice-cold Uno Dos Tres show. I know we've got an hour 15. I probably only have 15 minutes of thoughts on this show. The Kyoto show was fine. I mean, thank God we had a second topic this week, because there's nothing to really sink your teeth into there.
And to peel back the curtain a little bit, like... If this is the kind of stuff that y'all like to hear from us, I feel like with how the Dragon Gate schedule has been this year and seeing like how it, like, let me pull up how it looks like going into this, there's going to be times that we want to have a weekly show that there might not be as much Dragon Gate related topics. So if y'all are liking stuff like this or like the variants, so when we talked about like best junior heavyweight years, let us know, because with the way that Dragon Gate schedule is, that this might be a well we will be returning to, essentially.
Yeah, I am not into the build of this show at all. I'm extremely disappointed in how this promotion followed up their first week of the year when you had all of those Shimizu matches that bled into that Korakuen show. And I thought the January Korakuen show was great. And I think February has been a bad month for Dragon Gate. And I am not into this show. I am not into this main event. I don't think this show is going to draw well. I'm worried this show might not be very good. Let's break it down, Dreamgate match, and work our way down.
Yeah, and I think that if we're trying to find like the root cause to Dragon Gate's malaise in February, you have to start at the Dreamgate scenario. So on Uno Sos Trace, the main event will be Madoka Kakuta defending the open Dreamgate title against Yuki Yoshioka, a match that really has been almost 12 months in the making when you think about Yuki Yoshioka's return, but at least everything in the build to this title match dating back to King of Gate felt like that this was like, oh, we have this card up our sleeve of Yuki Yoshioka has a win over Madoka Kakuta in this tournament, so he's the only person who has a pinfall over Kakuta in general since becoming Dreamgate champion. Now we're playing this card here, and the follow-up has been confusing at best, throwing us back to memories of 2023 in bad ways in another vein. It's all been based on Kakuta taking out Yuki Yoshioka with a pile driver on the floor, and then Yoshioka returning the favor in Cork, and both of them had taped necks in Kyoto. The only things worth noting about this title program coming out of Kyoto was Yuki Yoshioka had a match versus Kai where he won with the reversal Samson after selling his ass off, and Madoka Kakuta just lurking watching the match. And then Yoshioka and Kakuta cut a promo, and that was our go home for the Dreamgate build. And now that we've caught y'all up, or I've caught y'all up on this, is it actually, are we at a situation where clearly Kakuta's cold as a champion case? We've been talking about how essentially they've done a similar build with Kakuta, where he takes out his challenger and it's, will the challenger be able to make the match? And then Kakuta rolls through them in the title match. Do they do that with Shun and they do that with Benkei so that Yoshioka is the one to overcome this? Or are we just going to have a 25-minute match that's going to end up being like what most of Kakuta's style run has been?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have faith in these guys as opponents. You know, I thought the 2023 Kobe World match was a very middling Dreamgate match, especially for the show that it was on, but I chalked it up to, I thought they were put in a very unfair position in the booking, where it was D-Courage versus D-Courage. At the time, my belief was, oh, they're gonna fade Yoshioka heel and have Kakuta work from underneath. And instead, they just had this ice cold babyface versus babyface, who gives a shit, we respect each other style of match. And I thought, all right, well, the second time around, they're going to be able to figure this out. You know, Kakuta's the clear heel. Yoshioka has an army of reasons to be a beloved babyface. And then I thought their King of Gate match was good, but I didn't think it was anything special. And outside of a few rare interactions in these tags and these Road 2 matches, I don't think these guys bring out the best in each other. I think individually they're two phenomenal wrestlers, but I've yet to be convinced that they can have a great singles match. And I think the build to this match has been cold. I'm in favor of what they did in King of Gate with Yoshioka beating Kakuta, but Yoshioka not winning the tournament itself. I liked the Valletta detour they took, but man, it just seems like Yoshioka, like, it's weird, right? They've been building to this match for a year, ever since Yoshioka returned from injury, but this build also feels rushed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it kind of felt like that this was going to be the plan for Kobe World, and that's why Yoshioka didn't challenge, and then you bring it, you revisit this, Yoshioka gets like another win, you know, in some sort of lead up in May, and then they're like, hey, I've got your number twice. We've been kind of circling each other ever since you turned on me last May, and now it's time to have that conclusion on the biggest stage. But maybe that there could be this being seen, like this playing out this way, versus what I think was the, not necessarily in any sort of way the consensus, but what felt like the usual logical kind of mindset towards booking what would be on paper the biggest match the company has right now. And instead, you've built this up kind of treating Yoshioka like another person to be kind of scraping by to get into this match. And then Kakuta takes off their head. And that's happening at a time where Kakuta just got announced for Champions Carnival. And is there anything to read into that as well? Like, in some ways, there's a part of me that wonders if this is like they had this card up the sleeve. They wanted to see how long Kakuta's champion can go. And then it was like, no, we can't do this anymore. We're playing the Yoshioka card and then not building up anything in the lead up to this match to provide any sort of counteraction to the idea that these two guys have bad chemistry with each other. Because it's been all right in the lead up. I feel like I've been a little bit more positive about it than you have been. But the fact that they've kept Yoshioka and Kakuta away without like Ryo Saito saying like, hey, we can't have you two in matches against each other until the title match because you all are just too unchained, we can't handle this, like without like a level of just like explanation or booking, it has kind of made this a very cold program.
I think, like, this was the original plan. I mean, it makes sense in the timeline of having the diversion and King of Gate into this, into Kakuta doing Champion Carnival. I don't think they want their Dreamgate guy losing in Champion Carnival, and I don't think Kakuta is going to get a massive push in that tournament. So it makes sense. You know, Yoshioka is going to come to America for the first time. They'll have their Dreamgate champion there. I'm sure they'll do Yoshioka versus Mathers. My guess is that's what they're setting up for one of those shows. The timeline of it all makes sense. I know he was Twin Gate champion at one point last year, but you got to remember, Yoshioka spent most of 2025 losing. And I'm so confused by the build to this because it's been a lot of him getting his ass kicked. And I just feel like if they were going to have him not win King of Gate and have him wait until January to challenge, then all of January and February should have been him beating everybody. And then he should have just beat Kakuta. He should have just kept the momentum going so that he inherits the belt as an unbeatable babyface. And instead I've had to see this guy get his ass kicked so much for the last 6 weeks that I don't care about this match.
Yeah, and it's so contrary to how he was booked as champion and leading up to being champion in 2022 when Kakuta was the Terminator. He would just, no matter what, in matches where he would get his ass completely destroyed, like the Eita Dangerous Gate match, it felt like, okay, Yoshioka wins. He maybe was pushed to his brink, but then he was able to push back and win. And you don't really have any sort of feeling of that sort of energy. Instead, like maybe me saying keeping them apart is the most charitable way to explain the booking, but it just does not. It feels weird that your Dreamgate program has been basically for the last like 6 weeks has been like hovering around the situation, and then when you should be having the big D Courage versus Gaja Dokuro matches that we only really saw one of since the match got made, you have Yoshioka have a 10-minute match where he gets his ass kicked by Kai and is able to convert out of Kai's finish, and then he's on his ass listening to Kakuta run him down, who Kakuta's not necessarily the most interesting mic worker or charismatic presence. It's just confounding, and it's impossible to go into this title match in Fukuoka with any level of anticipation, to be honest.
If Kakuta wins, which I just don't see happening, you would
5% at best.
Yeah. You would have to look at the future defenses as possible Strong Machine J, possible KZ, possible Dragon Dio, which I would be intrigued by, some Yamato, Susumu, Doi, Paradox deal, or Hamare. I think those are the defenses that would be left on the table for him. Admittedly, outside of Dio, none of those sound super appealing to me. If you're
realistic, to be honest.
This is the end of his title reign. I would be absolutely floored if he, I think it would be one of the more shocking results in Dreamgate history. Whereas if Yoshioka wins, you have the built-in Ishin match because he pinned Yoshioka in the Kingate semifinals. You would have to think they would want to do the Shimizu match at some point. Again, to me, the most interesting option is Yoshioka wins here and then Shimizu beats him a week later in Osaka, but I don't think they're going to go down that path. Fresh matches for a Yoshioka Dreamgate run would be a Dragon Daya defense, a KZ defense, a Strong Machine J defense, a Yoshiki Kato defense, and a Hyo defense. Those are the ones that immediately jumped out to me there. I think Yoshioka wins. It's hard to believe it's been 3 years since he's been Dreamgate champion. This is the time. There's nothing left for Kakuta to do. We'll chalk this Kakuta Dreamgate run up to a lower echelon Dreamgate run in the history of this promotion, and we'll move on and hope that Yoshioka is able to steer the ship just as he did in 2022.
Yeah, and I think that the there will be questions lingering overhead with Kakuta as Dreamgate champion coming out of this. You know, like it's just, you're absolutely right. This is it, because there's nothing that makes sense, and it feels like elsewhere on the card, like as the promotion's like moving towards March, April, and May, and especially looking at that Golden Coliseum show at the end of April, it does feel like that get the belt to Yoshioka. And if you're waiting into April for the title defense in Aichi, that's fine, because it does kind of feel like you have a Gaja Dokuro versus Saipatra steel cage warfare match possibly ahead of us. So I feel like pretty confident that barring injury that we will be seeing Yuki Yoshioka being named two-time Dreamgate champion on the 23rd. This is my main event. No changes coming out of Kyoto. It's remaining a three-way six-man. We don't have indication that it's going to be two falls, but I'm willing to suspect it will be the Open the Triangle Gate champions, Love and Peace, Hyo, Benkei, and Mochizuki Jr. will be defending it against the Natural Vibes pairing of KZ, Gyuchi, and Aki, as well as Yamato, Dragon Kid, and BB Hulk of Paradox.
So I want Yamato to do more meaningful things this year, but I am not into the idea of this Paradox trio as Triangle Gate champions whatsoever. I see no reason for them to have the belt. I think it's too soon for this Natural Vibes team. I really hope that this will be a continued trend in this preview. I really hope the Love and Peace team wins here.
Yeah, it feels like to me, the second that they added in Paradox, like it went from potentially like 60-40 Love and Peace retaining to now heavily Love and Peace retaining. I feel like Yamato is in there because he seems to work best with the with Aki, to be honest. Like I thought Aki looked really good in the Kyoto main event, like his best performance since the gear and character change. I feel like you have the Paradox team in here as like, okay, what are you doing, Yamato, on this show? We talked weeks ago about it was kind of hard to find the place for him. And then this very obvious situation became clear. And really, I'm really excited for semi-main events Gyuchi here. Like, that's kind of what I'm going into this match really hoping for. I think that he has really risen to the occasion. This Love and Peace trio has been just insane, as like any combination of Love and Peace has been great. They have had the most interesting Gacha Dokuro match of the last few weeks, and it just feels like that there's no reason to take the belts off them, and it's not ready. And although it would be like the classic Natural Vibes like revival, that like, okay, at their darkest moment, like 2 weeks ago, they were about to disband, but now they're Triangle Gate champions again. Like, that does feel like that is a possibility, but I don't think it's a really good one, to be quite honest.
I'm with you there.
Then we have our special 10-man tag match. Saipatra teams with Team 2000X versus Gacha Dokuro in what's an all-out war. I anticipate that this will be announced as no DQ. It's Shun Skywalker, Hamare, El Cielo with Pro Wrestling Noah, Takashi Sugiura, and Masa Kanemiya Case. That is the godfather and also the chairman. That is their current going with, and that just amuses me that that's what we're going with as nicknames in 2026. But they're going against Gacha Dokuro, Shimizu, Minoru, Kai, Ishin, and Kato, and I just hope that basically this ends with Shimizu taking off Hamare's head.
I don't understand what the goal of this match is. I'm really, really curious to see what they're trying to get out of it. Is it to further Cielo and Kato? Is it to further Shun and Shimizu? Is it to elevate Hamare? Like, I'm just trying to figure out why this match has to happen if it's just going to be like Segura pinning Minoru. I don't know what they're trying to advance with this, and I don't know where they go from here. Now, that is a question that could very easily be answered in this match, and I'll be happy to go along with that. But I could also see this match being pointless, and I'm a little bit worried about that.
Yeah, it became kind of clear to me, or at least like my radar kind of went up about most of the way through the Kyoto show, where Shun got unmasked, I'm like, okay, Shimizu and Kato, who will be the third member of Gacha Dokuro versus El Cielo in the cage? If we're doing it feels like that's kind of the end point here, and that this is just a stop on the way here. Like, given that the expectation that this is a no DQ match, like, I don't know if we should just anticipate like Shun Skywalker at what point just fighting unmasked during this, or is this just going to kind of be like a meandering brawl that like ends with Kato like cleaning Hamari's clock? Like, it to me, it seems pretty, I feel like that pretty strongly that Gacha Dokuro is going to pin Hamare in this, and that's kind of the way out of the scenario. I just wonder, like, is this really going to tip the hand towards a future apuestas, or because that feels like where at least members of this match are going towards, or are we using this then to build up something happening in Osaka or in Korakuen in a week, because it does not feel like that this accomplishes a lot unless you're using it to build to a bigger thing in the future, and that you have basically the Team 2000X guys to sell tickets slash you don't have logical booking to fill out Shun Skywalker's side any other way.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I do not have a good feel for this. I'm very curious to see what this leads to specifically.
Yeah, because it really does not feel like that this is going to be any culmination of anything. And I think that's a problem with having this match being built up in that kind of way. Going down the card, then, our Twin Gate match was decided in Kyoto. Case, we were dead right. It was pretty kind of clear that this was the direction that they were looking at going in. But after winning the four-way tag in Kyoto, the D-Courage team of Dragon Dai and Marcus Mathers made a challenge against the Open the Twin Gate champions of Jackie Kamei and Rita in what I hope is a great 12-minute match that ends with Jackie Rita with the pen, and we move on. And hopefully Marcus has some other solid stuff to end out this tour if this is not his final date.
Marcus Mathers, get used to eating the pinfall in this match. There's no other way that this ends without Mathers taking the pin, but I am quite excited for this. I think he'll work really well with Kamei and Rita. I think this is a fascinating match. I'm trying to think of the last time that an American worked a Twin Gate match off the top of my head, because I don't know. I mean, Peter Casa worked a bunch of Triangle Gate matches, but I think we're going back to Ricochet challenging for the Twin Gate belt at some point. That's how long it's been. So I'm looking forward to this for the novelty of it. I think Mathers has been very good on this tour, and I think that he is in good hands in this match specifically.
Yeah, no, I'm over the moon with how well this tour went with Marcus Mathers. I had some question marks about seeing how he would work in it, and he completely within the first week did away with them. And I thought that he was great in the closing stretch of that four-way tag. And him and Daya feel like a really kind of fun team and a different kind of challenge for the best tag team in the planet. And that's kind of my hopes for that there. Our last title match on the show is Rhoya Tanaka versus Genki Horiguchi. Tanaka was pulled from cards, but he is back as of Friday. He will be on the Nagasaki City show that will have Jiro Shinbashi versus Alexander Otsuka. And what I think is actually a good sign for Jiro Shinbashi that he's being promoted to do those kinds of matches now.
So, yeah, the Jiro thing is fun. I hope we get footage of that because I historically love Otsuka. The Tanaka Genki match, I mean, look, I don't think it's going to be that good. I will be the happiest man on the planet if it is a great match. I would not count on that. I actually have very low expectations for it. But I do like that we're getting a match where Tanaka is the heavy favorite as we continue to edge closer and closer to him breaking that defenses record. I think what's interesting, and this sort of summarizes my thoughts on the rest of the card, is I'm having a hard time when I look at the undercard seeing anybody other than Kagetora, which I don't think they're going to go back to. Mm-hmm. I don't see anybody on the undercard that could have a compelling performance on the undercard that would lead to a Brave Gate challenge. And so I'm really, really curious to see what that next step is. I think it would be poor booking if it was Kagetora, but I'm not sure who else is out there that can perform on this show. And then, you know, I'm assuming we're going to have a Brave Gate match in Osaka. Maybe we won't, but the turnaround there is the interesting thing to me, because Kimura's too big, Monte's too big. You've got a whole bunch of guys in a multi-man tag, and then Shinbashi and Awashi, that's sort of a wash there. So I'm excited for the match. I hope it's really good. I hope that Horiguchi has one last go on him, but this will be the Ryoya Tanaka show.
Yeah, and I feel like that, in a way, if you're going to have what you are purporting as this legendary Brave Gate run that you're going for the defense record, you should have a Genki Horiguchi title defense in that amongst those 12, right? Like spiritually, if he went all the way and broke Pac's record and never faced Genki Horiguchi for the title, wouldn't something be wrong about this? Like something like spiritually, existentially wrong about that?
Yeah, very much so.
And I looking towards future challenger, I think it's Gucci. I think, but I mean, the problem that you have is that there are no shows between Uno Dos Tres and the Osaka doubleheader. So like he would basically, looking at who Tanaka has on these two matches on these shows, he does not have, like, he has a preview against Horiguchi in Nagasaki. They're in Sasebo outside in Nagasaki the next night. He's in a D-Courage versus Gacha Dokuro 8-man tag that, which was taped. At least there's a Yuki Yoshioka versus Madoka Kakuta involved in that. But I don't know who 9 becomes. It doesn't.
Yeah, that's why I think the undercard is so interesting, is not that it's the typical New Japan heavyweight booking where it's like, oh, well, so-and-so, look at match number 4. That's going to tip off who's challenging after match number 8. But there's no way they can do that on this show unless they go to Kagetora, which on paper is a great match, but I think would be really, really poor booking.
Yeah, and that wouldn't make a lot of sense. So just breezing through like the undercard stuff. Kimura versus Monte is opening. I like Kimura and Monte as a combo. I think that'll be fun. Jiro Shinbashi versus Toru Owashi. So Jiro gets that kind of comedy match on the first big show of the year. And I don't see Kagetora because this is a 4-way tag team match. Masaki Mochizuki and Don Fuji, the All Japan, All Asia Tag Team Champions. Susumu Yokosuka and Kagetora, the Soryo Tag Team Champions out of Ryukyu Dragon Pro Wrestling. And then you have Mandai Ryu and Pancho Monaga, okay there. But then you have Strong Machine J and UT as the last thing. I think they're using this as like a build to Korakuen in the All Asia match. So I don't see how Kagetora could be the challenger coming out of that.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think that's good analysis.
But that is the card for Uno Dos Tres. Hopefully we get to see something unexpected and great in the main event, but I'm really looking towards the Twin and the Triangle Gate matches to kind of sink my teeth into, because a lot of the other stuff on this show, I just don't see that necessarily being the case here.
I'm with you.
And that is it for Open the Voice Gate for this week. The next time you'll hear from us in this feed will be those days, talking about 1995 in the first Fukumen Mass League tournament. Case, we've been both kind of doing our prep for this week's episode or this month's episode, and I'm really excited to get into this later this week here. Do you have anything you want to tease that we're going to talk about next time folks hear from us?
No, I'm just excited to get back at those days. I think it's going to be a really fun episode.
I have Fukumen Mask League lore to talk about, and I'm really excited about that. But you'll hear from us again later this week on the feed talking about those days, and we will be back next week to do review this Uno Dos Tres show. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate, both on Twitter and Blue Sky. Case is on Twitter at _InnerCase. I'm at Fujiheya. The Voices of Wrestling Discord is one. Make sure to give a shout out to that. As we talked about for a lot of this episode, a lot of good conversation happening in the Discord and especially in the Open the Voice Gate channel. That's where we will have the match listings for those days later this week, but also just a lot of general discussions from things this last week, varying from CKY Shima AI generated videos to this Shima multi-man discussion, but there's also the Dragon Gate channel there as well. And that's going to do it for us. Next time you'll hear from us, we'll be talking about Michinoku Pro. Take care, everyone.
Hey, everybody. My name is Jesse Collings, and I am the host of the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, a show right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. On the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, we take a deep look at individual issues and stories that are going on in the wrestling world. Each episode is about a different topic, and we take a thorough and educated look at things ranging from current booking trends to breakdowns of individual performers and angles to investigations into different fan cultures across the industry. In addition, we keep a close eye on the wrestling media, and as a professional journalist, I bring a unique perspective to how current issues in wrestling are being covered and discussed through the wrestling media. We have a revolving series of guests from across wrestling punditry joining us on each episode, and we hope that you make the choice to give us a listen on wherever you get your podcast from.